great.
It's primal.
Uh-huh. Yes.
It goes back to that. And it comes out of the very source of us, that tree of life. And of course, it goes back to the garden. And there are other religions, whether it's Hindu or even Baha'i, which goes back to the Islamic, back mm-hmm. to the garden. Mm-hmm. That primal thing that's us mm-hmm. is the tree, because that's where Adam and Eve and the snake. So this idea of the origins, mm-hmm. and if you have that feeling of the origins, woo, everything is out of that. So,
man, I love it.
Yeah.
So how do we capture this in one dimension, in the flat dimension
exactly.
of writing?
Right.
That's our challenge.
Mm-hmm. First of all, I just really want to thank you for your question.
Yeah, my pleasure.
What a question to ask me. Because when I started writing this, maybe the memoir, maybe 20 years ago, I was traveling with the Harlem Spiritual Ensemble.
Okay.
Maybe even before that, when I was doing Porgies and Besses all over the place. I began to do a lot of observing. In order to be a singer the way I am, you have to spend a lot of time quiet, and you're doing a lot of observing. Because you use your voice without a microphone. That kind of power requires charging the batteries. So that's what I did when I went to different cities. You don't go outside seeing.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go visit your girlfriend across town or your boyfriend you went to college with. You stay, and that's when I got to serious meditation.
Uh-huh.
Because I found that I could charge my batteries. And when it was time for the performance, it's like bringing the butterfly out of the cocoon. You just let it, the wings, and you let yourself fly. And I discovered that you can build that up.
Mm-hmm.
No one had told me that. My voice teachers in college or graduate school never explained that to me, but I discovered it about myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I had also discovered that on stage I was at home. So I would observe a lot of things around me. And I also started serious reading, although I've been reading since high school. But I started serious reading about black people,
uh-huh.
James Baldwin, Langston Hughes, certainly Maya Angelou, and other biographies that I thought were relevant to me. Because when I graduated from Oberlin, I was in Pittsburgh at the time, mm-hmm. and I thought, I don't know who I am. And that's another one of those statements that comes from, you know, your very core all of a sudden. Why are you saying that? Where'd that come from? Of course you know who you are. You came from here, you went there, and you went, no, I don't know who I am. And that question lingered in a long time. So when I started writing, that question kept imposing itself.
Yes.
Who are you? Why are you writing? What are you writing? What do you want to write for? Because, and the reason that question kept coming back to me is, when I originally started writing, I was in graduate school. I got a couple of things published in these collegiate collections that would come out from time to time. And they published everybody, mm-hmm. to be honest, because that's how I got in. I was into hiding.
Uh-huh.
I think that was the primary motivation to write like Keats or Shelley or, you know, those romantic poets. But don't really say, I really want to have sex with that guy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I want to make love to that guy. His hair, his eyes, his neck, his thighs. I couldn't say that in my early writing, whether it's poetry, a short story, or whatever. So all of those early efforts were to hide.
Mm-hmm.
But there was something compelling me to write.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't make sense.
Yes.
To write to hide. So as I was traveling with the Harlem Spiritual Ensemble, this thing kept coming up. You have to tell your story sometime or other. So the initial feeling was I'd write it, but no one would ever read it.
Yes.
So I began to write, and lo and behold, the truth started coming out. I said, oh, Lord, everyone's going to know I'm gay. And that was a frightful thought in 1967, 68, uh-huh. 69. I've been with Fred, and there had been some private discussions about my sexuality. Subsequently, I had gotten married. That had not worked. And then I'd gotten separated. And so I was spending time really alone. I had a lot to think about. And I decided to start telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And the writing was a very big part of telling the truth. Stop hiding. You have one place that you can tell the truth. And it was in my writing. So, in trying to tell the truth, I thought, if I just start where I am right now, people won't know who I am.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that became a paramount motivation. Who are you? Since you don't know who you are, who are you? And I began to think about the things that formulated me.
Mm-hmm.
What were the things that contributed? And once I sat and thought a lot about, as I traveled and observed, slavery was the word
mm-hmm.
that I realized I had avoided a lot. It was embarrassing. Slavery was embarrassing. It was a subject that I never felt comfortable discussing with my peers or white people,
mm-hmm.
non-black people, and Asians, Native Americans. I could not discuss slavery comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, I need to go back in my privacy and read about slavery, because what I realized was, that's who I am.
Mm-hmm.
I am the product of slavery in this country. And of course, I don't have to go through every detail, but eventually I had to go back to Africa.
Uh-huh.
So the singular most painful knowledge was that came out of that was the collusion between black leaders in the communities who many times kidnapped their political rivals or the enemies in
yes.
the next village and sold them into slavery.
Mm-hmm.
That took a long time. I mean, maybe like 2 or 3 years.
To kind of get to that place where you were realizing that or writing about it or?
Just to make it my own.
Yes.
It just seems so unembraceable.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Mm-hmm.
We sold our own into slavery. Woo! That was one of the hardest things I ever embraced.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't get my arms around it for the longest time. And so, once I began to accept that, I relaxed. And I went back to what I was writing, what specifically I was writing about. But always there was that feeling of going back and getting that unpleasantness,
mm-hmm.
that foul, spoiled thing, and saying, that's a part of you too.
Mm-hmm.
That's a part of you. So, then I began to think about slavery in America, and that was profoundly humiliating.
Uh-huh.
And I met some people in New York who were, from my perspective, pioneers.
Mm-hmm.
They were the real pioneers who did talk about slavery. And I really sat on the outskirts. I sat on the fringes with them because I thought they were dangerous. And I thought, boy, if I hang out with those guys, I won't sing opera anymore.
Uh-huh. Yes.
I won't be able to go to Lincoln Center anymore because they were not terrorists, but guys who were going against the system. They were,
mm-hmm.
they talked against the system. So I had a terrible time being with people that I thought I should be with.
Right.
There was something inside of me compelling, saying, if you want to do what you think is what you're saying you want to do,
mm-hmm.
you've got to hear them out. You've got to give them a fair hearing. And all the while I was trying to write about my youth and what it was like in Ohio and Alabama to Ohio. And the thing about it was, I wanted to know a lot about black people.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to write about black people. But the cruelty that I had a horrible childhood. The cruelty that was visited upon me was by black people.
Uh-huh.
What a conflict I had. You know, my mother, my father, my stepfather were brutal.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only word to describe the monster of my real father and the monstrosity of my stepfather. I don't know which was worse. And so, the people around me, I couldn't trust.
Yes.
That word of trust. And I thought, I'm trying to learn about the people who are abusing me. And it made me a false introvert.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really an introvert.
Yes.
But I fled the brutality.
Mm-hmm.
There was no place to go but inside. So I kept reading, and I kept writing, and I kept watching and wondering. And then I read about slavery, and then I read about Africa, and I thought, oh my God, everybody's cruel.
Right.
Well, I thought, this cannot be true.
Oh. Uh-huh.
There must be some good people in this world. And yes, I began to find them. But there again was a huge conflict. They were white.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they caused slavery.
Mm-hmm.
They raped our women. They segregated our schools.
Mm-hmm.
Our houses were redlined. Wages were low. There were so many instances of overt, present, everyday, cruelty that I was living in conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And then my parents were telling me, oh, you can't trust this one. You cannot trust that one. Oh, be careful. But the ones I wanted to get away from were black.
Right.
They were the.
Right.
I thought, where do you go? In that process, I began to develop my own philosophy. I had to test every single person. Much to my surprise, the stranger was the kindest. I began to say, they're not right. My parents and my relatives, who were cruel to me, were not right. They did not have the definitive answer for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kept this to myself, but I began to build a wall between us because of their cruelty. And whoever came to me with kindness, I opened up to.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to build my family. I said, I don't care if they're Chinese, Vietnamese, Japanese, white, Irish, black, whoever it was, I was going to make them a part of my inner circle.
Mm-hmm.
Along with that, I had this experience, which we talk about, where I left Louisiana to Mississippi,
yes,
to Alabama, and discovered that I could sing.
Mm-hmm.
Singing was the key out of the ghetto. I discovered that.
Mm-hmm.
This little pee-pee voice that I had when I got to Youngstown, Ohio. And the people who liked it were white.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
Well, I was in kindergarten and PK. When I went to church, the preacher liked it. Oh, the preacher, he was black. Thank God.
Yeah.
So the preacher and then the deaconesses and then the deacons and all, they began to say, oh, that little boy, Buttercup, he can sing. So my key then became anyone who liked my singing,
mm-hmm,
that was my new friend.
Mm-hmm.
And that key was what took me out of the ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
I would go to church, I would come back. I went to their flower clubs, and I came back. I went to their, like, the Kiwanis Club. Those things took me out of the ghetto. And when I got to first grade, second grade, third grade, oh, Francois, what a sweet voice you have. Come over here, sing this. Oh, I'm getting attention.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't like at home. And I discovered, because it was my boy's realization, that I spoke two languages.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke one language at home and another one in school with the teacher. I was the teacher's pet. And the kids teased me, and I learned to accept their big teasing me. But I absolutely never forgot that if I sang a song, I didn't have to go back to the dungeon.
Uh-huh.
I walk on the street. I said, oh, which language should I speak for these people? Which one? How should I talk for them? How should I talk for them? And I began to realize that my compatriots, my peers, I had to speak ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
That's what, if I started, mm-hmm, the other one, the boy, who do you think you are? So, all right. So I began to define that there were two in there. Then, the church had me singing and the school had me singing. Well, I began to have friends, and I began to define my life. But in that process, and I'm writing about this, of course, I discovered I like men. Mm-hmm. There's something inside of me that wanted to be really close to my buddies. I'm 7, 8 years old. I'm totally satisfied with them in a certain way. But they play too rough. Mm-hmm. Elbows, wrestling, pushing you down, socking you. I began to spend more and more time with girls. But I didn't want to be intimate with girls. They were just my friends, my buddies. I could play jacks, jumping rope. Oh, I was fabulous. Jump forever. And the games that girls like to play, dolls. I've always had a feeling for dolls. And I wanted to play with dolls forever. My parents would snatch the doll away. They said, boys are not supposed to play with dolls. And smack. And it broke my heart, to be honest. That was part of my introvert. I decided to go mm-hmm. further, and I retreated. Mm-hmm. I must never let them see how much I enjoy playing with a doll, combing her hair. There was a way that I could translate some of that to my sisters. I had twin sisters, younger than me. So there were times when I could comb their hair. Mm-hmm. That was permissible because my mother worked mm-hmm. at night, and the fact that she could give that responsibility over to somebody else who frequently did a better job than she did because she was tired, mm-hmm. was a heaven sent on several levels. I could comb their hair, I could iron. I learned to become a very good housekeeper. 8, 9, 10 years old, it got me brownie points. And then in the church, by the time I was 10, I was conducting the choir because I was a busybody. I was busy, I had energy for singing. And the choir director had the insight to say, come over here, sit down. Now sing this part. I sang it. Come on, alto, sing what he's singing. And I did it. Okay, tenors, sing what he's singing. And I did it. Okay, bassist, come on. And I woof it. I wasn't a good bass, but I could sing it. It's easy, it's gospel music. It came to me secondhand, second nature. So I began to have a certain success in church, but I liked the guy Richard, one of my boyfriends in the church. He said, no, you only kiss the girls like that, Francois. You can't just, mm-hmm. you can't kiss me like that. Oh, so we can be very close, but I can't kiss Richard. And a couple of the other guys began to say, no, you only do that with the girls. You can't do that. Mm-hmm. So I found that I was accepted in a certain way in school, but there were limits. I was accepted a certain way in church, but there were limits. So I began to try to, wind your way. What do I do? How do I? So Buttercup the Sweet, Buttercup became the most introverted. Mm-hmm. So I'm writing this book and thinking, my life, somewhere I've got to tell the truth where people understand. This is a gay boy trying to grow up in this society.
Yes.
Has no models, mm-hmm. no one to talk to. When mm-hmm. I tried to mention to my buddy, no, you can't kiss like that, you can't hold. You only want to do that with girls. No, I don't want, I want to do it with you. No, you just think you do, mm-hmm. you don't. There was absolutely no one to talk to. Mm-hmm. So when I wrote this book, I'm writing it for the little gay boy, the little black boy, who wants to do these things that other kids want to do to the same sex. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a single book to read. Mm-hmm. Where am I going to get the manual that tells me it's okay? Mm-hmm. Go ahead, kiss him. He won't die, and neither will you. You're not going to hell. Mm-hmm. Because later on, I did a lot of praying. So when you talked about that, I thought, now it's important to know how you got there. Mm-hmm. My parents and everybody talked about Jesus. So I started reading the Bible.
Yes.
It brought me deep satisfaction about my deep inner nature. But I couldn't find forgiveness. And so I kept writing and I kept trying and I prayed, I walked, I meditated, I chanted. I did chants over and over. Forgive me, Lord. I'm not a sinner. take this away, cleanse me of this stain. And I continue to write the whole time. I know this is going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
It won't always be there.
Mm-hmm.
So there were all these conflicts. My parents were brutalizing me, and I'm thinking I'm not a worthy person. And then I'm from slaves. I don't have money. I'm in the ghetto. I don't have educated parents who are on the PTA mm-hmm. or who would mm-hmm. bake sale. They didn't cook. Yes. They didn't do shit like that. I didn't have clothes to wear. There was a whole string of socially unacceptable things. And I said, I've got to write to help people to understand. But at the same time, I've got to bring in the cruelty of slavery. So, because when I would talk to my kids here or at Oberlin or Carnegie Mellon, they don't know about slavery and things uh-huh. like the Holocaust. So they don't know what's contributed
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
to who I am to get to this point.
Mm-hmm.
So I have an Aunt Bess. Unfortunately, last week she just had a stroke. She's 90-something.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Me too, boy. But she was my source.
For a lot of the kind of...
information.
Info prior to your...
Being
prior
born.
To you kind of being... Yeah.
Yeah. And what the relatives were doing.
Mm-hmm.
She was my non-condemning relatives. The one out-and-out relative who approved of me the way I was. Mm-hmm. I am. Unfortunately, she was like 1% out of
yes.
1,000.
Yes.
And it took me a long time to trust Aunt Bess because she was so non-judgmental.
Uh-huh. You kind of couldn't believe she was for real.
Yeah.
A little bit.
I didn't trust her.
Uh-huh.
I did not trust her. I went to Oberlin. She was living in Cleveland.
I actually have two quick questions. One is, how did this little boy get to Oberlin?
Mm.
Because that's extraordinary to me. And what shifted that this book that you wrote for that little boy came out, came to us, just came out into the world?
To Middlebury?
Just to be, that you shared it.
Ah.
So how did that book finally leave your, just the embrace of just you writing it for the little boy?
Well, it didn't happen until I got to New York. After I recorded Porg and Bess. That was the time that I was doing less Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood
mm-hmm.
because Fred had said stay in the closet.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was what year?
Mm-hmm.
Because it was what year?
1969.
Right.
Yeah, and 70, like that. And of course, I was staying in the closet because there are many reasons. I didn't want to hurt him. I didn't want to lose the show.
Mm-hmm.
I knew the value of what I had. But at the same time, that to me was not a sacrifice in a certain way. Because 95, 96, 97% of the people who belong to Actors Equity
mm-hmm.
belong to Screen Actors Guild and who belong to AFTRA, American Federation mm-hmm. of Television Radio. They're not working.
Right.
They're waiters and waitresses.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They're computer helpers. They do housework on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And
you were working.
I was working. I had a job on a gold platinum platter.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it.
Mm-hmm.
And... The other thing I'd like to say, but I have to say this in a nice way because I don't want to say it in the wrong way. Fred had all the money.
Mm-hmm.
Entitled, white. He had stature in the society. His family has... He was a blue blood
right.
by my definition.
Yes. Yes.
And so when he makes a suggestion, it's always considered.
Mm-hmm.
Always. I say it's 75-80% almost a complete
mm-hmm.
because of what he has
yes.
behind it.
Yes.
I never had it. Nobody takes me to even today. I could have all the money and want to do it. And they'll say, well, they'll be making suggestions and trying
mm-hmm.
to change it, all kinds of stuff.
Uh-huh.
But not when a man like that
mm-hmm.
makes a suggestion. And he makes it to a poor boy from the other side of the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
He makes a suggestion to me, and we on that side know which side of the bread the butter is on, so to speak. So Fred made that suggestion to be Officer Clemens and to come on his program. First of all, I said yes. But then to be Officer Clemens, then I thought, it's like asking me to dance on needles. And I said, well, how the fuck am I going to do this? Well, you're trying to figure out how to do it.
Yes, yes.
You're not thinking, shit, no, find something else. You don't do that. You say, wow. You stall for time. I stalled for time. To try and get him to make another offer. Can I be a doctor, a lawyer, a professional music teacher? A post, not a postman because they already had one. Something that had community and societal respect. Mm-hmm. Something that a person who comes from slavery through the South, the incredible de facto and segregated laws that they lived by, to getting to Youngstown, where my parents worked in the steel mills, to Oberlin, to Carnegie Mellon. Isn't there something else I could do to show that, or something, but not a policeman?
Right.
So I'll get that, and then I'll go back to my grandmother, Laura May, because she is, to me, pivotal to when I was born. When I was in high school, I was in the chorus with Mr. Miller. And I was also in the band. I played clarinet. And I was damn good. But they met at the same time. And those two gentlemen got together and they decided, we really need him in the choir. He's got an extraordinary ability and he's not going to stop. Anybody, he had like 35 clarinet players and maybe five or six tenors. So they decided, and they kind of told me, you're going to go to the choir from now on. And I made my peace with it. I wanted to do both, but they weren't hearing any of that.
Yes.
They were two white men. So I started going only to the choir. When I got to be a senior, I was assistant choir director. And he often asked me to go off and have sectionals with the tenors. And the baritones, too, sometimes. And I would teach the guys the parts. They didn't like it when I did that because they said I was mean. I meant business. If I had a job to do about music, I was serious, and they were not. And that's they were in it for the girls. Most of the guys joined the choir to be with their girlfriends, and they sat over there smiling and playing with themselves because they were all going through puberty or whatever, and they were smiling and making jokes, and I wasn't interested in any of that. Because I was gay, and I was much more interested in them. And there was a part of me that was very jealous that I had no attention, so to speak, from them, except when I sang solos. When I sang solos, I had enormous attention. But when I was teaching them their parts, they thought, oh, come on, take it easy. Why are you doing all that? Why are you working so hard? So that when Mr. Miller always told me when I got back with the boys who had been working with me, they were better than when he took them. Because he kind of indulged them, and he understood he was a heterosexual man. And I'm not saying a heterosexual man couldn't do it, but he didn't crack the whip like I did. I was definitely pay attention or get out. That was my attitude. And they say, nowadays when I was did with my Harlem Spiritual Ensemble, they said, Myrna comes out. Don't say anything, don't do anything. They said, I'm not a very nice person, and I know that I'm not. I'm like this.
Good job to do.
Yeah, I got a job to do, but I also love it. And they're messing around, I don't put up with it. I was paying them, and that's what I expected them to do. So that was one reason I stopped conducting the Middlebury College Choir. The kids were too frivolous, and they weren't serious, and they didn't come to rehearsal. They said, I had a Russian exam. Oh, I had a paper due tomorrow, and you didn't come to rehearsal today? My attitude, I could never do it, but my attitude was get out and never set foot in this room again. That's what I would like to have done. It just didn't work.
Yes.
So I went back to the administration and said, you have got the wrong person conducting this choir. I won't do it anymore. Oh, it's not the case. I said, the kids don't come.
Was it different when you were at Oberlin?
Yes, much different. On the Robert Fountain, are you kidding? It was an honor to walk into that room, that sacred room, to work with him on that music. And plus, other kids had the same disease that I did.
Good, good.
Oh my God, it was so exciting. And we competed. We had extra rehearsals. It was thrilling on that level.
I bet it's still different. I mean, Oberlin's such a serious music school. I bet it's different today. Francois, how did you get to Oberlin from where you...
One day, I was called to Miss Kreisen was the name of our, what do you call her, the social...
Guidance counselor.
Guidance counselor. And she said, You didn't sign those papers to go to the vocational school, young man.
Oh, God.
And everyone else has signed them, and yours, you didn't sign them. What's the matter with you? What are you planning to do?
Oh, my God.
And I said, oh, I think I'm going to go to Oberlin. I had met a social worker, and she had heard me sing and said, I will pay for your voice lessons as long as you attend. And I thought, wow.
As long as you attend Oberlin?
No, attend my voice lessons.
Oh.
And don't mess around and don't go unprepared. I was at the Episcopal Church in Youngstown. His name was Ron Gould, and her name was Mary Lou Davis.
You even heard of Oberlin at that point?
No. He was the first one ever mentioned it. I was in 10th grade. So I started studying voice with Ron Gould. And Ron was a bit of a taskmaster also, but I was totally up for the job. The harder he worked me, the harder I worked. And I learned Handel and Bach and Mozart and Schubert, everything. German, I don't know how I learned that German. But I did French. It was brand new to me. Mm-hmm. A ghetto boy coming up there into his house in the white neighborhood and then going back to the ghetto and back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So when he prepared me, the work and stuff that I had to do, because I lived within 100 miles, you had to go and do it a lot. So my parents did not want to have anything to do with it. They didn't want me to go. So my high school music teacher conflagrated with me, and we went on Saturday when I was supposed to be going to his house to work on high school music, and he and I drove to Oberlin, and he said, I'll pay for it. I'll take care of you. He drove me to Oberlin, and my Mr. Ronald Gould, the music teacher, prepared me. We didn't tell my parents. And the two, he and the high school music teacher, conspired. They took me there. I auditioned. I did very well. And a guy named Daniel Harris, who was the person who listened to me, said, you'll be hearing from us. I gave him my music teacher's address instead of my home address. And he said, and so we went out to lunch, and my music teacher drove me back to Youngstown, and we were mum. We never said a word about it. Then, while I was waiting, high school, when the lady called me, by the way, she said, Mrs. Kreisen, why do you think you want to go to Oberlin? You're not one of them. I said, one of them?
Mm-hmm.
What is that? She said, you're not one of them. You're not going to survive there. You're a ghetto boy. You should want to be a cook. Or a tailor, or a bricklayer, or a carpenter, where you can always make a living or something. She said, you'll be very disappointed up there. You're not going to make it over there. I said, I'm on the honor roll. I've got very good grades, and I'm going to study hard, and I'm going to do what my teacher. Oh, it doesn't matter about that. That's nonsense. And how are you going to pay for it? Oh, she was so arrogant. And Diva Clemens was born right at that moment. And I stood up and I said, how dare you tell me where I'm going to go? I can go wherever I want to. I don't know where it came from, but she was born. And I stood up to her, woman to woman. I did. And I said, you don't have a right to tell me where I'm going to go. I'm going to go wherever I want to go. And I've already talked to my voice teacher. And I've talked to the music teacher. And I know that I can do very well. I'm a good student. It all just rolled out of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm never coming back in here again. Goodbye. And I walked out of her office without an apology. And I stood up. I was so proud of myself. I said, boy, you're going to get it. The principal's going to call you. You know he's coming. Well, it did take about 2 or 3 days. But the old loudspeaker, Francois Clemens, would you please come to the office? The principal wants to talk to you. I said, oh, I'm going to get killed. I'm going to get thrown out of school. I'm trying to get to Oberlin. What do I tell anybody? Oh, of course, when I got there, he was busy, so I had to sit and wait. He calls me into the office, and he actually stood up and came around. Well, 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 young man, I hear that you want to go to Oberlin. He said, that's my alma mater.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Yes. He said, guess what? I said, I'm going to help you.
Wow. That is nice.
I'm telling you, you could have dropped a lead balloon on my head. I was so shocked.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to help me? He said, yes. You got any money? I said, no, sir. Well, you're going to need some help. You made any plans yet? I said, no, sir. I don't even know if I've been accepted. He said, I have an idea. I think we're going to do something. He said, I'll be in touch with you. Mrs. Chrisen told me about that little conversation you had in that office. And he said, I'm proud of you.
Wow.
Said, you stood up to her, didn't you? Where did you get the nerve to talk to her like that? She told me everything you said. I was ready to die. I thought I was just going to wilt away into the... And he said, no. He said, I'll be back in touch with you. Well, to make a long story short, those guys got around and conspired behind my back and talked to the Oberlin Alumni Club, and evidently they knew before I did that I was accepted. Mm-hmm. I hadn't gotten the acceptance yet. And what they did was talk to the Oberlin Alumni Club in Youngstown, and they literally paid for my first year at Oberlin.
Oh, my God.
They paid for it. And when they saw that I did very well, by January, February, the Alumni Club said... that they had worked out an arrangement with Oberlin where they would give the money, but Oberlin gave me a free ride, essentially, mm-hmm. after that. So that's how I got to Oberlin, mm-hmm. and that's how I stayed there on a full ride.
Man, that's amazing.
That is spectacular.
And somebody well bigger deserved. Than you
yeah,
and I.
Yeah, for well, sure.
Somebody yeah. bigger than you and I. And my parents didn't want me to go. So, to make a long story short, I moved out of the house in a week or two with one of my girlfriends, Elaine. She's such a wonderful sister, and her mother and dad said I could come live with them, and I left my mother's house. I never slept under my mother's roof again. Never did.
Wow.
We had such a terrible, terrible time. I said, I'll never be back. You're too cruel.
Mm-hmm.
You're mean to me, and there are people who are not mean like you.
Mm-hmm.
I won't be back. I left. I took my two or three little things. And I went and I stayed with Elaine and her mother and her sister and her brothers. And they were very kind to me. There are lots of more details. It's in the book I left out because there were other things that she did to try to get me to come back. And my stepfather was mean. They were fighting and they beat me up. And when they came to the principal's office, I took my shirt off and showed him where he had beaten me and stuff. And the social worker and all said, put out a restraint order.
Uh-huh.
He couldn't come near me and all that, so
mm-hmm.
then I wasn't afraid anymore
mm-hmm.
that I was going to run into him on the street and stuff. But
sounds like you started your new family with Elaine.
I did, but also with my music teacher, and because he literally adopted me as his oldest son, I could say. And my music teacher in high school, Mr. Miller, he really treated me as though I was a member of his family.
Mm-hmm.
So there were people, and I was watching all the time, can I trust her? Can I trust him?
Mm-hmm.
And Mary Lou, for a woman, a white woman, who was only 2 or 3 years older than me, she was 23, 24, she was paying for my voice lessons. She did that for 3 years.
Wow.
Years later, when I'm telling you, that's what it did to me too. I said to Mary Lou, why did you do that? Why did you pick me?
Why did I pick
that? That's what I said to her.
Yeah.
Why? And she said, I just did. I just felt something. When I saw you and I thought, if you'll study, I'll pay for it. And she said, don't worry about me. Because I kept saying, can I pay you back some kind of way?
Mm-hmm.
Come on, Mary Lou, let me. She said, nope. She said, do it for somebody else. You know that movie, Play It Forward?
Yes. Yeah.
She was doing it long before that movie.
Yes.
She said, do it for somebody. Promise me. I promised her. And you know, I've been here 22, 23, 24 years. I have taught so many kids over there. I never accepted a penny. Never. And I told them, no, I'm not allowed. He said, what do you mean you're not allowed? You're a tacit. Yeah, but there's another law. There's mm-hmm. another rule. I can't charge you. Come on, let's go take a lesson. Sometimes two and three a week. Some of my Jamaican kids, my
yeah.
Romanian kids, because of Mary Lou.
Mm-hmm.
And I took her out to California and I did Porgy and Bess out there. Oh, we had and she had a little baby. She brought the baby so I could meet the. And she's. I know it sounds stupid. I kept saying, Mary Lou, why did you choose? Why did you do that? All that? Because she was so young.
Yes.
She was young. And she met this Chinese guy. I can't remember his name right now. But I kept saying, why did you do that for me? Because she took me to Pittsburgh. She took me to shows.
Uh-huh.
Like Don Giovanni. Uh-huh. And there was I remember one of them was a Bali. B-A-L-I. Bali.
Mm-hmm.
Dancers. I never saw anything so exotic in my life. And I said, Mary Lou, What is this?
She saw that you appreciated your gift and that you took it seriously.
And she took it upon herself.
Yeah.
In a certain way. She was the first person to really, really, really tell me that American Negro spirituals are some of the greatest music ever. Mm-hmm. I said, coming from a white lady, you're saying that? Yes. She said, you can do whatever you want with it, but I'm telling you, it's some of the greatest music ever written. And you're one of the best singers of it I ever heard. She said, something inside of you comes alive when you sing this repertoire. She said, promise me. Oh, God. See, you open it up. I'm sorry. That you will always sing this repertoire. And so when I got to the Metropolitan Opera in New York City, I'll never forget, there were a lot of stuff in the memoir that leads up to it. Mm-hmm. But I got to the Metropolitan Opera there, and there was an assistant manager named John Gutman who had his numbers from Auschwitz. He showed them to me. Mm-hmm. And we bonded over this number. And I talk about it in the autobiography. And he said, sing me a spiritual, Francois. In the Met here? In your office? Sing me a spiritual. I've heard about you. I said, you have? He said, yeah. So I sang Swing Low Sweet Chariot or There's a Balm in Gilead. I don't know what I sang for him. It was so. When I got through, he said, you and me, we understand suffering. He said, I'm going to do a concert in a couple of weeks, and I want you to sing a couple of spirituals. He said, there's something about you when you sing a spiritual. He said, whew. He said, we know pain. He said, I know pain. Mm-hmm. You do too. And he became one of my mentors, because there were three or four of those conductors, Maestro Strasvogel, Gutman, and I can't think of the other one's name. His name will come to me in a minute. But they had all been at Auschwitz together and survived.
Wow.
And they had gone to music school before that in either Austria or Germany, I can't remember, but when they got to America, they found each other, and they were like this. Mm-hmm. And whenever they were doing something, they would call me. Mm-hmm. We want you to come sing three spirituals. I said, but I know how to sing Elisir d'Amore, and I know how to sing Faust. Salut de mire chaste pure. I've studied French. I said, yeah, we know.
Sing the spirituals.
Sing the spirituals. Mm-hmm. You bring something. You give us something that we haven't. You remind us of Auschwitz, they told me.
Man.
You bring back the pain in the way. And the three of them would sit together, and I sang for them. And so, for the rest of my career in New York, they used to put on these incredibly special concerts. I mean, it was like singing for the King and Queen of England and, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Denmark. It was a very special group of people that used to come to those concerts. And when I got through singing, sometimes they just very quietly stood up, because I reminded them of what they had gone through. I respected them. I loved them for it. And they said, this is the one time in public that we allow ourselves. I said, with you. And they called me Mr. Clemens. They never called me Francois. Mm-hmm. They never called me France. They never called me office. Mm-hmm. Mr. Clemens. I don't know why they said, but you've been appointed as the one. And you're not Jewish. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're not Italian, and you're not German, but you're it. And when I got finished singing, I would go off stage. I'll never forget, my colleagues would be standing around in a half circle. And one of the girls said, now, who wants to go next? Nobody wanted to go next, so we just stood there together as the tree. Mm-hmm. We were all one. Mm-hmm. And I've always had the ability to do that. There's no competition. We're one. Mm-hmm. We're in this together. And I saw my career like that almost all the time. We are one. We're doing this together. I couldn't do it without you. You can't do it without me. Mm. So, I'm sorry. Where were we?
Don't be sorry. You have had a life that generates a lot of goosebumps.
It's fascinating. Yeah.
And to make that connection and that bond like that. Those are my people, so I'm grateful for that.
Oh, wow.
I know of that.
You know what I'm talking about.
Well, only indirectly, because...
Well, they told you. They share that. You know, the reason I know the stories about my people, and I'm going to tell you about my great-grandmother in a minute, is that they tell us so we don't forget.
That's exactly right.
We must, mm-hmm. And we're close exactly to that right. Shit now. We have to stand up.
Yeah.
Kind of when I write on Facebook,
yes,
we must not forget. There are people now who would like to return to those days.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are being reminded.
Yeah, it really
yes.
Seems like you're reaching into the past to kind of tell something about the present. And it seems like your grandmother is important to that for
yes.
you.
Yes. My great-grandmother, Laura May, because we have to know what the white man did to us. They raped our women and they killed our boys. And they're killing them now more than ever, and they're having our women. We have so many. Middlebury College is a prime example of our mixed heritage.
Mm-hmm.
We have so many mixed boys and girls here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't have anything against these mixed children. None whatsoever. In fact, 10 or 15, maybe one a year, two a year, sometime would come to me and say, help me to understand who I am.
Yeah.
I've had the white part. Now I need to know who my black self is. And mm-hmm. they'd be the prettiest little girls and handsomest boys
mm-hmm.
saying, I need to know. Help. And I just take them into my life and say, okay, let's sit down and chat and talk. And sometimes they had just wiped out all of that. And another boy, Bullock, was on the basketball team.
Mm-hmm.
He said to me, they don't know my grandmother's a black lady. When they start that talk in the locker room,
mm-hmm.
they say things. He said, it hurts. It hurts so much. I'm talking about my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I love my grandmother. Here in Middlebury.
Mm-hmm.
This is not in the South.
Mm-hmm.
This is not below the Mason-Dixon line. This is right here in Middlebury, Vermont.
Yeah.
There are many stories like that.
We have about 10 more minutes.
Oh, Lord.
So I know. An hour goes quickly, doesn't it?
Oh.
And I know you have miles to go, so I want to protect your hour, but
uh-huh.
is there anything? And I'm praying that this has worked.
Yeah.
Because I will spend time with it. I haven't.
Yeah.
But is there anything in particular you want to ask before in the next 10 minutes?
Well, I guess, I mean, I feel like so much of what you said could be, like, extracted and moved around and would speak
yeah.
to a lot of
yeah.
what I was asking.
I'm hoping.
But, yeah, I guess I'm just really interested in how well you capture the point of view of somebody who's related to you but who's not you, and I don't know how well you knew her. And you do such a great job making me believe that I'm, you know... seeing what she's seeing, and it sounds like your aunt gave you a lot of source material, but how do you make us believe that we're there with her?
Well, first of all, I think that I feel like I'm Leonardo da Vinci, a man of many talents, and I'm curious about many things. I feel I have the body of a man,
mm-hmm.
but I have the heart of a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And because I have the heart of a woman, I can enter into what she felt like
mm-hmm.
as a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And in the culture, I have found my greatest success when I allow the feminine to dominate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to. As a boy, I said to you, I didn't play rough football. I could play it, but if they started tumbling and carrying on, I got out of there. But I could, the feminine side, I could let have almost free rein.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they were telling me I couldn't be gay, the times that I allowed myself to feel like a woman were my most creative
mm-hmm.
times. So my creativity and my leadership even
mm-hmm.
is powerful, but
mm-hmm.
it's still feminine.
Yeah.
And which is what helped me to understand in my meditation that the creativity of the world, of the universe, of my soul, that thing that's deeply inside of me, it's masculine and it's feminine.
Yes.
It's not that feminine was created later
mm-hmm.
with a rib. That doesn't
mm-hmm.
work for me.
Mm-hmm.
It is one at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So that when I think of history, when I think of characters, I often feel the feminine
mm-hmm.
much deeper, much stronger
mm-hmm.
than I feel the male
mm-hmm.
character.
Sure.
And so an understanding the role of my great grandmother Laura May wasn't second nature to me. Uh-huh. It was natural. She was the babysitter at the house. We were around her. I watched her. I loved her without trying. Mm-hmm. The things that she said to me were like, you know, the spirit writing on the Ten Commandments that she said, do it, mm-hmm. you did it. She said, don't do it, you don't do it. So I never had a conflict. When I sing spirituals, that's the voice that I hear.
Uh-huh.
That's the power that tells me, go, mm-hmm. do this. It gives me authority. I don't let anything question it.
Mm-hmm.
It takes away fear also. I'm never afraid when that voice speaks to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm supposed to do. If it means that I give up this body, I give it up mm-hmm. on that authority.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is more powerful than that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the source that I bring truth to life, mm-hmm. to power through that. And so nothing is more powerful. So that's it. I feel what she has, what she gives me.
Mm-hmm.
I dream about her.
Mm-hmm.
I am keeping my commission because I cannot tolerate this disapproval. If I can't explain it, but mm-hmm. I have a commission.
Mm-hmm.
My commission is spiritual. It is with Fred Rogers, but it's with her approval.
Uh-huh.
That you are doing the right thing. Keep on. Yes. Go on.
Uh-huh.
That's her.
Uh-huh.
And I the older I live, the longer I live, the more I realize that source.
Mm-hmm.
And how important it is to acknowledge it. Because the more I acknowledge it, the stronger it gets. I had two strokes last summer. I don't know if we talked about that.
No, I didn't know that.
I had two strokes last summer. While I was lying there in bed, it's like you turn the computer's the software is messing up. You turn the computer off, and then you turn it back on. And when you turn it back on, everything starts rebooting.
Wow!
I rebooted.
Yeah.
In the process of rebooting, this is the next step in my commission. There was no pain. I just lost all sensation.
Yes.
On this left side, I couldn't move my legs. I couldn't move my arm. I couldn't say the word persnickety. And things like that. You know, there's a lot of slobbering over here and looking yes. at yourself and saying, you know. And I used a wheelchair to a walker to crutches to a cane.
Man.
And now I'm it's all back. But I have a new commission, and that new commission is the Tree of Life.
Uh-huh.
And so my great-grandmother and Fred worked together.
Uh-huh.
And frequently my mother, she died in 2010.
Yes.
Frequently she takes her place along there with them and giving me, I invoke the ancestors
yes.
now.
Yes, yes.
I have the, I don't want to say wisdom, I have the commission
yeah.
To invoke the ancestors when I sing, when I perform,
uh-huh.
when I rise. I rise with a different authority.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's no accident to me that people have responded to my writing now. It's that I'm there now.
Uh-huh.
It's like a different phase in life.
Yes.
And I have different things to do, but I'm being given the utensils to do my job.
Uh-huh.
It's like a testament before you're born. This is your job. We've given you all along the way the utensils, the necessary tools, and you have arrived. You have been obedient. So we will.
Yeah.
We will not forsake you.
Yeah.
So when I walk out, I walk out as a different. Fred mentored me. That was his commission.
Mm-hmm.
You come.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was black and I was gay, and there are many people, I still am black and gay, not was. And there are many people who say, why do you want him? What do you want him for?
Mm-hmm.
But if you follow the scriptures, which I do, you take the Old Testament. They say the brick that was thrown away, the builder didn't want it. That is the brick that God took. And he made it the cornerstone of his temple.
Mm-hmm.
That is Old Testament.
Love that Old Testament.
Pardon?
Love that Old Testament.
I'm telling you, girl. And that's the one he took. And I'm the brick they threw away.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want a gay boy. Don't be gay. And don't be black. Give me some blue eyes and some blonde hair.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't do that, we don't want you.
Mm-hmm.
And Fred said, no, No, I want that one. That was his commission. And he'd have been in trouble if he hadn't done it.
Yes.
Just like I would have been in trouble if I had said no. But I had learned by that time to trust. And I was on the lookout for him. I know that sounds crazy, but I was looking for him.
Mm-hmm.
He became my daddy,
mm-hmm.
my surrogate daddy. And the day he said to me, I love you.
Yeah.
I've been saying it for 2 years, but you heard me today.
Yeah.
Ooh. I saw stars in that studio. And I saw him. That was the day I didn't see him as a white man anymore.
Yeah.
The love was so powerful. It was throbbing. It was bright. It was like firecrackers. And when he hugged me, it was like God hugged me. I don't mean that I was worshiping him or anything.
Yes.
But it was a divine hug.
Mm-hmm.
It was not physical. It was, we agreed our commission.
Was like a mutual thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was when I woke up,
mm-hmm.
and I became aware of who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since then, I have been doing my job.
Yeah.
He'd be so proud to see your writing out in the world.
Yeah, I really think so.
What's it like for you to see your writing out in the world, even just this little bit?
You did it. This is the first, you know, this is the first time I've been published.
Really?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, we have to say something about that.
Everybody else said no. I sent out a lot of them.
It's great. I mean, the material is great.
Oh,
yeah.
It's amazing.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's really special.
I put in a lot of time.
I believe it. I can tell.
You know, when they say if you get paid $2 an hour or $1.50.
Right. That'd be good. Yeah. That'd be high on that thing.
I could go out to an island. I could buy an island.
Yes.
If I could. Oh, I mean, I was so grateful when I got that check. I almost didn't want to cash it.
But what's it feel like to hear people responding to your work and just to have put it out there after it was such... you know, such a private endeavor for so long.
For so long. It's very enriching. It's fulfilling.
Good.
It's very satisfying, very fulfilling. And it also makes me feel deeply honored that you took a chance.
And you're paying it forward. Think of think of the people who will read this and take strength and courage from it and support.
What's the status of the whole work?
Well, let me tell you, first of all, we stopped working on things because I actually have written and finished a book on Fred Rogers.
Really?
Yes, called Won't You Be... There Are Many Ways to Say I Love You.
Oh, that's a great title.
Because
of the song.
Yes.
Yes.
And so Elizabeth Copps, who's my literary agent, back there, I guess, February or March, she said, Francois, you know, in your book, you've got 2 or 3 chapters that really talk about Fred. You need to talk about him a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And then she said, no. Take those chapters out.
Mm-hmm.
And let's do
make
an outline.
Separate.
What would you do? Yeah, separate mm-hmm. those chapters. And what would you do if we did an outline
mm-hmm.
of 12, 13 chapters of experiences that you had with Fred that were quite significant?
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, that's easy because I was with him 25, 30 years.
Yes.
So that's what we did. And she helped me with the outline.
Mm-hmm.
And then she said, and believe it or not, I started writing. Because I think Fred started channeling me. That's how I say it.
I believe that, yeah.
He got involved. And so the next thing you know, I'm just writing. And I'm sending it to Elizabeth. She said, keep on. This is what we want.
Mm-hmm.
So the book deals with, like, when I went to Cincinnati Opera and they shunned me because mm-hmm. they were on a court order from, the Metropolitan Opera people said, do you want to integrate Cincinnati? And, they thought I was from Ohio because I lived in Youngstown
mm-hmm.
from 5 to mm-hmm. 20 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah, I'll go, but I'm from Birmingham. They said, well, you know, just tell me you're from Youngstown. So I went out there, and the management hated it. And eventually the NAACP got involved, mm-hmm. all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that was... And so Fred was my guardian angel. I called him. I said, Fred, they didn't come to the airport. They didn't see me at the hotel.
Yes.
They're not saying hello to me. They're not talking. They walked out of the first rehearsal, turned the lights out, left me in the room.
Oh, my God.
They didn't even say, rehearsal's over. See you tomorrow. Fuck you. Nothing. So I called him, and he said, when it's over, knock this sand off your sandals and come and be with us. That's Old Testament also. But Fred and I were always quoting biblical things as to how to deal with the world that we lived in.
Mm-hmm.
There were just all these things that happened. There was this another conductor who I was in this gorgeous concert hall, brand new. The Corbett Foundation had given it to the city. And the way we did, went around the country.
Mm-hmm.
Fred did guest appearances, and he took Lady Aberlin, me, Mr. McFeely, Johnny Costa, and many times Joe Negri.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like a little package deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I would always started warming up and singing with orchestras because I warmed up. I'm a morning person,
mm-hmm.
and I warmed up first. And it was just our package. Lady Aberlin was always the last one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I walked into the theater, where the orchestra was rehearsing, and I was getting ready. I say, "Maestro, I'm ready to go. We usually start with me." And he said, "Who are you? What are you doing here? Get off of my stage. I don't know you. We'll do whatever I say we're going to do." Everything stopped. I was humiliated. You will not sing with my orchestra if I say you can't sing. You're not supposed to be here. Just get out of here. I don't even know what you're doing here. Well, everybody swallowed. Johnny Costa got up from the piano. I went downstairs to get my coat. I was going to leave. Lady Aberlin came into the dressing room. Mr. McFeely came in. Joe came in. Everybody. And as I was getting ready to leave, Fred came through the door and said, "What's going on here? What happened?" He always came a little bit later. He went swimming, and then he would come. Well, when we, everybody's telling him at once what happened. So then, I was quiet because I was pissed. Then he said, "Let's go back upstairs and see what's going on here." So we went back upstairs, and we got back up to the stage. The orchestra was just livid. They were pissed, and they were also shocked that evidently a new conductor had spoken. They were just so excited about doing the Mr. Rogers concert.
Mm-hmm.
They had been practicing it.
Mm-hmm.
They knew we were coming for weeks, months.
Mm-hmm.
And so for them to see him go off like that, they were not ready either. So as Fred is leading us in, this ragged bunch of people who are just so upset, "Oh, Mr. Rogers, how are you, Mr. Rogers? I'm so happy to see you. We've been waiting."
Wow.
And Fred just stood like that. "Excuse me. We can have our greeting later. I think you and I need to talk. What happened this morning? I understand that Officer Clemens was going to rehearse with you, but you feel differently. What is the problem?" Oh, that's Officer Clemens. Oh, he's supposed to be..." "Yes, and you said some things to Mr. Clemens that were not very nice. Did you mean those things?" "Oh, I didn't realize he was supposed to be on that. "Well, I think you owe him an apology. And it has to be now. Otherwise, we are going to close up shop and cancel this concert now." "Oh, Mr. Rogers, please don't cancel. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean it." And he started fawning on me. And I didn't want him to touch me. "Don't touch me."
Mm-hmm.
"After what you said to me a little bit earlier." And so he said he was sorry. I know he didn't mean it, and I didn't want to hear it. But they made him say he was sorry and everything. And I just, it was a horrible experience, to be honest about it. It was so humiliating. So they, I wrote about that. That's not in any of the other material. You can see it in the movie.
Wonderfully, yeah.
Oh, well, it was a horrible experience. So those are the things I write about, how Fred...
Uh-huh.
Has another dimension that you don't see it in the movies, you don't
right.
read it in any other books.
Right.
If you want to know who Fred is, you got to read my book,
because yes.
there's another side to him.
Yes.
I'm afraid we're going to have to
throw
end
me out.
I'm not going to throw you out, but we need to end this here. I'm